to speak about the United States and the Arab Spring, first I have to make a few introductory remarks. I think the best introduction to the subject of the United States and the Arab Spring is what happened recently in Yemen. Here was a chance for the United States and its allies of the Gulf Cooperation Councils, those exemplary democracies that the United States arms and finances and supports. And they managed together what they call transition to democracy in Yemen. So we had a chance to see firsthand the fruits of their labor. They did have an election. It was an election like no other. In Iran, as you know, as undemocratic as it is, there are people who run for president, and it's always more than one person. In the U.S. GCC-managed election of Yemen, there was only one candidate. And that was hailed as a great achievement for democracy and for the United States. But that's not all. We now have the results of that election. The guy won with 99% of the vote. In other words, he did better than the last dictator. And the last dictator handpicked this guy to succeed him. But this is exemplary of the way the United States envisages change in the region. But more on that in a second. I cannot speak on the Arab Spring without expressing my strong disapproval of the term. It seems to me when blood are on the streets, there is no room for references like Arab Spring or Arab flowers. This is insulting to the people who are dying in Syria and Yemen and elsewhere. So we need a different terminology. I mean, I refer to them as Arab uprisings. They are not revolutions by any means. Karl Marx spoke about revolutions in terms of the replacement of the political and social, by social he meant socioeconomic, of course, the political and social order. None of that has been achieved. I mean, in Egypt, the current prime minister was prime minister under Hosni Mubarak. The military council which rules the country are all handpicked by Mubarak himself. So certainly, we are very far from a revolutionary situation. Having said that, I think what's been happening in the Arab world is just beginning. I mean, when you think about world revolutions, whether it's France, Russia, and Algeria, and so on, we speak about a long process. I mean, if you think about the French Revolution, I mean, it took decades for its effects to take shape. I mean, you know the famous exchange between Henry Kissinger and Zhou Enlai, the Chinese prime minister in the 1970s. Henry Kissinger famously asked Zhou Enlai, what is the Chinese Communist Party view of the French Revolution? And Zhou Enlai famously told him, it's too early to tell. And it's too early to judge pessimistically the outcome of Arab uprisings. But certainly they are not spring. Certainly they are not spring. And I think this terminology, like Cedar Revolution and so on and so forth, they come out of Washington, D.C. for ideological reasons in order to leave a certain imprint on these uprisings. And one of them, they want to do analogies with previous experiences. And of course, the Arab Spring is like the Prague Spring, that they were anti-communist, and they were in a direction that the United States can approve of. This cannot be said about what we're witnessing in the Arab world. Before I speak about the United States' handling of the Arab Spring, so-called, I should say something about the features of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East on the eve of Arab uprisings. It's fair to say we now know more than ever the centrality of Israel in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. We now know that the 80 million people of Egypt amount very little to the United States in comparison to that precious Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. You all know the U.S. Congress is basically holding Egypt hostage in order to impose on the Egyptian people the preservation of a widely unpopular treaty, the preservation of which through the decades required the installation and arming of a brutal dictatorship from 1979 all the way until now, Mubarak and after. And when we speak about the centrality of Israel, we're speaking about different elements here. One of them is the United States is committed to the military superiority of Israel vis-a-vis any Arab neighbor or non-Arab neighbor and any combination of forces. A military general in Israel was bragging yesterday that we are the strongest. We are the strongest party and the strongest military within a 1,500 kilometers circle. I mean, of course, this is why whenever the United States is preparing to get rid of an enemy of Israel, be it Iraq in 1991, being Iraq in 2003, and Iran now, they always have to exaggerate the military power of those powers, and they make them, I mean, they make them something which they are not. They are certainly not on the level of Israel, which the United States keeps at a situation of superiority unmatched by any other countries of the region. The second element of the Israeli thing is that the United States want to preserve the treaties that it forced on the Jordanian people and the Egyptian people and on Lebanese people. But I'm proud to say, since I come from Lebanon, it lasted for a few months in Lebanon. The people revolted against it. Many of you do not remember, in 1983, the United States forced, under the shoes of Israeli occupiers, a peace treaty with Israel, which the Lebanese people got rid of before it even reached parliament. In Jordan and in Egypt, the dictatorship in both countries maintained those treaties against popular wishes. And of course, it is not accidental that Lebanon is the more politically open, more democratic than Jordan and Egypt, and that's why it defied U.S. will in order to impose a treaty on that country. The third element of the Israel question and American foreign policy is basically undermining enemies of Israel, no matter who they are. No matter who they are. I mean, somebody in my generation, I'll be 52 next month, in my generation, I am not fooled by all the rhetoric about Islam and fanaticism as a premise of U.S. concerns about Iran or about some other, or Hamas or any other factor that is bothering Israel. I am of a generation where the United States used to oppose Marxist, feminist, socialist, who used to oppose Israel. Under the rubric back then, that they were part of a communist international conspiracy, now we place them into a large Iranian conspiracy. I mean, we just change the labels. But the United States premise is the same, that enemies of Israel are not going to be allowed to live, whether as organizations, as individuals, or as states. The United States want to get rid of them, to kill them. The United States want to kill enemies of Israel whenever they arise, no matter their ideological stripes and orientation. The fourth element of U.S. strategy is basically to maintain Israeli monopoly of nuclear weapons in the Middle East. I mean, it's a very simple policy. It's a simple policy, but has more than a tinge of racism to it. It's a policy that requires you to believe that nuclear weapons in Jewish hands are safe. But if they are in Arab, Muslim, or Christian hands, they are harmful. I mean, that's or in Muslim hands, non-Arab, like in Iran. I mean, that's the argument. I mean, there's no other way around it. The United States does not trust, and of course the United States, having been the only power that used nuclear weapons, cannot trust nuclear weapons except in the hands of the state of Israel, which has committed more wars than any other state in the region. I mean, Iran is not a democracy. It's a clerical dictatorship that I personally am in favor of its overthrow. But the last time Iran launched a war was in the 19th century in the region. Israel is a country that is based on institutionalization of wars, massacres, and war crimes. I mean, I argue that these elements of Israel are not accidental. These are not policies of Israel. These are the only ways by which Israel can survive. Because it is a state, it's an entity that exists since 1948. Let us not erase history here. Not 1967. Since 1948, has existed by brute force against the wishes of the original inhabitants. It can only live and survive against the wishes of the Palestinians and everybody else by force and by support from the United States. The second element of U.S. foreign policy on the eve of Arab uprising is the imposition and the creation of a tyrannical order. extending from North Africa all the way to the Gulf. I mean, when we speak about tyranny in the Middle East, we are not speaking about an order that existed totally in contradistinction of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. The United States set it up. It inherited an order from the British. It consolidated it, expanded it, and armed it further. When people speak, there was a question in the previous panel about why Morocco and Jordan and so on. I mean, the answer is Morocco and Jordan are blessed with very strong U.S. support, one. And two, they are blessed with financial support and largesse from the Gulf countries, from the European, from the American, the World Bank, and the IMF. I mean, it's not accidental. It's not accidental anyway. The tyrannical order exists at the service of U.S. foreign policy and continues to exist with that goal, and the United States has protected that tyrannical order. I mean, of course, there are exceptions. Syria and Iran are not part of, I mean, they are tyrannies, but they are not part of the U.S. tyrannical order, although in the case of the Syrian dictatorship, it has oftentimes worked and cooperated with the United States, and back it was during those honeymoon times when the United States were very closely with the Syrian government. I mean, cooperation between the Syrian dictatorship and the United States continued after September 11, began before September 11, and let us forget that the Syrian and the Egyptian dictatorship in 1991 were the two powers that lent legitimacy, Arab and Muslim legitimacy, to the American invasion of Iraq at that time. At that time. So the United States is far more willing to consider an overthrow of dictatorship that do not fall in the American-managed and held tyrannical order. This is not to say that the United States is in favor of the overthrow of the Syrian regime, which is a point I argued recently, and I will contend if I am asked about it. I still believe that the United States prefer a tyranny, in the case of Syria for sure, as opposed to whatever alternatives may come up later. The third question, of course, is oil. The United States, you know, we have seen in the case of Iraq and Kuwait how hard the United States is willing to fight wars in order to keep the supply of oil at terms and prices that are agreeable to its interest. And we also know from unclassified, declassified U.S. documents from the 1970s that the United States had back then, I mean, we don't have the secrets now, not yet. Back then, the United States had plans on the books to invade Saudi Arabia and those countries and to take over the oil fields. And I mean, you'd be naive to assume that those plans have not been updated over time. The fourth element is the United States want to preserve its economic interest. My colleague Joel Beenin spoke about that previously. Five, it's not only that the United States is trying to preserve a tyrannical order. The United States fights tooth and nail against any democratic movement that threatens its tyrannical order. The United States has fought in supplied arms and assistance to the Omani dictatorship against the rebels in Dhofar. I mean, Yemen is a very good case where the United States has been, in the name of fighting bin Laden and al-Qaeda, also been assisting the Yemeni dictator in fighting a democratic, sometimes socialist, sometimes liberal movement inside Yemen. And the United States basically has figured that democratic change in the region is antithetical to its interest. And for that, it will continue to fight it, as I will argue. And in that regard, the United States not only supports the killing of dissidents in the Middle East, it also participates in the killing of dissidents. I mean, the crackdown in Bahrain, the crackdown in Saudi Arabia. I mean, you don't hear, if you only read American newspaper or the New York Times, you would not know that people have been killed in Qatif in eastern Saudi Arabia over the last 2 weeks, unendingly. You would not know that poets have been arrested and bloggers and so on. You can go on the website of Amnesty International to find these cases, but these are not advertised. Now, let's talk about the Arab uprisings. First of all, I mean, there are many conspiracy theories about the Arab uprisings. And those conspiracy theories are flourishing over there, in the East, and over here. I mean, In the United States, the New York Times came out with a funny story that said that the Arabs protested because they read the writings of a retired American academic by the name of Gene Sharp. Most of you have never heard of that name. I haven't heard of that name until a few years ago. Gene Sharp, I mean, I was partly part of the story. Gene Sharp apparently is a writer on nonviolent struggle, and he has many booklets in which he writes about that. And if you read these booklets, as I was compelled to, as I will tell you why, that is, a few years ago, you will read some of the pearls of wisdom that are contained in these books. For example, he says when people demonstrate, they should wave their flags. I mean, prior to that, prior to Gene Sharp coming up with this wonderful original idea, people used to wave, I don't know, shoes or T-shirts, but they never thought, why not waving the flag? So all that wisdom is contained in the writing of Gene Sharp. So a few years ago, I don't know if any of you have seen the documentary that is put out by his proteges, which basically promoted him. And Al Jazeera, Arabic, aired that documentary several times, and the director, I'm sure he regrets that, sent it to me, and I wrote a very scathing review in Arabic and in English. And in that documentary, it suggests that the Arab protesters really are influenced by that documentary. And to attest to his power, he says, well, yeah, my writings have been translated into 40, 50 languages. Well, I don't know about the other languages. I am part of the story of the Arabic language. I was contacted by his institute called the Albert Einstein Foundation in Boston, by his executive director, which appears in the documentary, and I was asked whether I would supervise a translation of his writings into Arabic. So he himself, with money he gets, I don't know from where, is commissioning translation of his own work. And then, when asked about his own influence, he says, well, they are translated into other languages. So in other words, he uses what he does as evidence of the popularity of his writings. Now, let me say this. If you go to Cairo, and if you spend 8 hours stopping people at random in Tahrir Square to ask them about Gene Sharp, I am willing to give you a blender if you will find somebody who has ever heard the name of Gene Sharp. But that was one of the theories, and of course it came out in the New York Times. But there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that, which is, if Arabs do something that some people in the West admire, that is not in the realm or the zone of terrorism and so on and so forth, we cannot believe they can do that on their own, right? We have to always credit the white man. It must be a white man who helped them. It was Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, when you think about that movie, I mean, a guy doesn't warrant a footnote in the history of that era, and yet, in the minds of many Westerners, well, he's the one who fought against the Turks and led the Arabs to defeat, political defeat. But that's a story. Now, on the other side, there is now a persistent trend among progressives and also among supporters of the oppressive Syrian regime. And according to this scenario, all the Arab uprisings are a plot by the United States. And I must confess that this, I mean, I wrote against it recently in Arabic. I must confess that this is really traveling wide, especially among progressives. Many of them are believing it. They believe that, they use many examples, but one of the things they see is that, I mean, the fact that the United States is not fighting for democracy, but we've known that all along. That's not evidence of that. But they also point out the fact that democratic change has not produced has not produced desirable results or outcomes in Tunisia or Niger and so on and so forth. And the fact that the Islamists are working very closely with the United States on economic and political issues. So they point that as evidence of the conspiracy. And if that's not enough, the Syrian regime media fabricated an interview with Henry Kissinger in which Henry Kissinger, allegedly, and this interview is being like widely disseminated and it has been translated to English, and according to it, Henry Kissinger says, yes, I am behind the Arab Spring, I create all these revolutions, and I mean, it's things that effect. I mean, it's hilarious, but it is widely believed. I see it on Arabic TV screens all the time. My take on that, of course, is that, of course, it's not true. The United States is extremely happy with the tyrannical order and would do its best, use its forces, use its economic power to preserve the tyrannical order and not change it. And I'll give you examples as I proceed about that. The United States was sweating, even it doesn't want to show you that it was sweating. The United States treated with the Arab Spring the way one deals with the news of cancer. First, there was shock, disbelief, denial, and then coping. But certainly the United States was taken aback. Certainly it was surprised. It didn't expect it. I mean, with the quality of some of the people who lead Middle Eastern policy at the National Security Council and Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East at the State Department, that's not surprising. As you all know, the top Middle East man at the State Department, Jeffrey Feltman, when the news of the uprising in Tunisia spread, he was famously quoted as saying, "Well, I'm not worried about Egypt. Egypt is not Tunisia." I'm sure he probably later thought Yemen is not Egypt and other countries are not Egypt. But that's the extent to which the United States was prepared. It certainly was in denial. It could not believe that these things are happening. And then they started with the coping. And the third thing they did, which is an important part, is launching the counter-revolution. Launching the counter-revolution in cooperation with Israel and the client state of the GCC, who control the Arab League. Now, if you take it a case-by-case study, look how the United States handled it. I mean, what is rather amusing about U.S. foreign policy to the Arab uprising is that the Obama administration, without any timidity, gives credit to itself for supporting the Arab Spring. I mean, if you study the record, it is absolutely farther from the truth. The United States, in every single case, stood against the protesters in those countries. Syria is a different case, which we can discuss. But take Tunisia. The United States stood by Ben Ali to the very end. It's true. Obama is often cited as calling for his resignation. He did. When Ben Ali fled the country, when his plane was in outside of Tunisian airspace, that's when Obama got the courage and called on Ben Ali to step down. I mean, that's his true story. That's his true story. Study the record. The United States did not want him to leave. And then when it was inevitable, the chief of staff of the Tunisian army told the Egyptian newspaper Al-Masr al-Yawm that he was contacted by the American to launch a coup to preserve the regime. I mean, this is part of the counter-revolution. How can we save the regime and get rid of the dictator? That's what they did in Yemen. I mean, the relatives of the dictator in Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, are still running the intelligence and the military branches. And his hand-picked successor, former Ministry of Defense, the guy who led the brutal crackdown in South Yemen, is in charge. That's a scenario of change that the United States can live with. But the free choice of the people is not something the United States can live with by any means. Then came Egypt. I mean, Egypt is the most interesting case by virtue of the significance of that country. The United States, as part of the coping, I will say that in a second, but the United States first was clearly not amused by what happened in Egypt. And the New York Times reported that every day the King of Saudi Arabia and the Israeli Prime Minister were calling Obama to pressure him and lobby him to stand by Mubarak no matter what, no matter how much violence he used. And he did. He didn't need any lobbying. He did stand by Mubarak. Mubarak was allowed to kill hundreds of Egyptians, more than 800, in a very short period of time. There was no remark about that. There was no condemnation. In fact, in the first week of the crackdown by Mubarak, the State Department spokesperson said, in the daily press briefing, we call on the protesters in Egypt to desist from violence. That's why they were dying. I mean, maybe he meant that they should stop accepting the bullets in their bodies. They were blamed for being killed by the Mubarak regime. The United States stood by Mubarak to the very end, when it became impossible for him to stay in power, given the wide popular tide of opposition against him. The United States came up with, they always have a transition roadmap or a transition plan. They had a plan. The plan was, the Egyptian people are complaining about the dictatorship and they want to bring it down. So why not get rid of Mubarak and put in charge, I don't know, the head of the secret police, Omar Suleiman. I mean, that was exactly the plan for Egypt by the United States. And that plan, by the way, is still being considered Omar Sulaiman was met by the Saudi government. There are rumors that he is now an advisor to the Saudi Minister of Defense, Crown Prince Naif, and so on. The United States is not necessarily done with Omar Sulaiman, especially because he's very dear to the heart of the Israeli government. I mean, this is like saying that the problem with Hitler is that we can put him aside and let's put Himmler in charge. I mean, that's the way the plan came across to the Egyptian public. And of course, the Egyptian public kept pressing until they insisted on free elections in Egypt. That's when the United States put in place the coping mechanism. And the coping mechanism, I mean, given that there's a trial in Egypt now, Hillary Clinton was very clear. They immediately allocated $50 million to support pro-democracy groups in the Middle East. I mean, they are blatant about it. It's not only they are blatant. They are blatant in the U.S. right to fund political parties that they like in the Middle East to further their own interests. I mean, imagine if China argues it can support and fund political parties in the United States in American elections. I mean, worse than that, the U.S. Congress is now threatening to withhold funds from Egypt, which goes to the military dictatorship anyway, if the Egyptian government does not allow not only groups to receive funds from Egypt, but to allow American various so-called NGOs to operate in Egypt without a license. I mean, against the law. I mean, who speaks about the law when it comes to the United States, right? I mean, the laws are meant for the Egyptian people, but not for a superpower like the United States. And in Egypt, the United States is not done. Egypt is very central. It will set the course that will signal the direction of the Arab uprisings for months and years to come. And that's why it's intervening in many ways. One, clearly by insisting on the preservation of the military dictatorship in Egypt, the United States does not want the military to step down. They know that Israel is sweating. Israeli leaders have not stopped shedding tears over Mubarak's fall. We know that. I mean, as a signal, I mean, as you all know, Thomas Friedman famously said that there is no foreign policy goals for the Arab uprisings. Since Mubarak fell, the Egyptian people have bombed the gas pipelines to Israel 12 times. I mean, every time, I mean, I was at Oxford University a few days ago, and I said, maybe next week it'll be another one. I mean, next week there'll be number 13. My point is, how many times do the Egyptian people have to bomb the gas pipelines to Israel before Thomas Friedman believes them that they do have foreign policy goals in their uprisings? They do. There's no question about it. And that's what's alarming Israel and the United States. That's what's alarming Israel and the United States. And for that reason, they both know that that treaty will not survive without a dictatorial imposition. And for that, the United States will not allow a transition to power. Now, they are working behind the scene to arrange for a puppet, a former general, Omar Sulaiman or Ahmad Shafiq, to be the president of Egypt, to basically maintain the treaty. And of course, they are also cooking things behind the scenes under the table with the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood, lest we forget, is a historically opportunistic organization with a long history of dealing with the United States and reactionary forces around the world against progressives. As you all know, Muslim Brotherhood and its outgrowth on the side of the Cold War were on the other side. They were not on my side as a young man. They were on the side of the reactionary anti-communist Pinochet and all the right-wing dictatorships around the world. That side they were on. And they were the side on the King Hussein. They were the side of Saudi Arabia. And they still are. They still are. And it seems Hamas is returning to its root as a reactionary organization run by Gulf countries. And then, of course, the Arab uprising spread. In the case of Yemen, the United States was able to manage it for the time being. In the case of Libya, the United States basically wanted a heavy use of force in order to come across as hero in the eyes of the Arab. But that effort did not impress the Arabs much. The model of change in... I mean, the Arabs do not have to read books to basically suspect the intention of the United States. They only have to look at cases where the United States manage change. They look at Iraq, and nobody ever regards Iraq as an exemplary democracy. Yesterday, we were celebrating the one-year anniversary of the crackdown against a forgotten uprising, which took place a year ago in Iraq against the government. The people of Iraq also protested against their dictatorship, and the people of Kurdistan in the north also did. They were shot at, they were tortured, and they were imprisoned, just like others. But that's not famous news for the New York Times. In the case of Libya, the United States found a dispensable dictator who was an ally of the United States since 2003, as you know. And he's rendered many services, just like other regimes, especially torture services for the United States government. He was expendable. And now what do we have in Libya? NATO should be credited. If you are a fan of Bin Laden, you should credit NATO for producing a Bin Laden, first Bin Laden regime in the Arab world. I mean, the militias that run Libya today are Bin Ladenite fanatical militias. And one of the first order of the day that was announced by the so-called leader of the Transitional Council was the return to polygamous marriages in Libya. I mean, that was the first important announcement that he saved for the Egyptian people after the so-called liberation of Libya. Not to mention that in any case when the United States fights war, in any case when NATO fights war, innocent people are killed in the name of liberating innocent people. There were investigations by human rights organization, and there is an unsaid number of innocent people killed by NATO in the name of United Nations Security Council resolution that allowed military intervention in the name of protecting civilians. So killing civilians for the protection of civilians is an irony that only U.S. great power can come up with. Syria is a different case. In the case of Syria, the United States being very duplicitous. The United States being very duplicitous, I don't think the United States is honest about its intention. I still believe the Israelis and the Americans most likely would prefer the dictatorship to stay, but weakened. To stay, but weakened. And then they can produce yet another precious Israeli-Syrian treaty. And they were close in previous times. I mean, the Syrian government is not opposed in principle. All Arab governments are on the same line when it comes to the Arab-Israeli question. They all signed in to the horrible Arab-Israeli peace plan, which was put on by the King of Saudi Arabia after a lengthy meeting with Thomas Friedman. That's why I call it the Thomas Friedman peace plan for the Arabs and the Israelis. And of course, the Israelis did not accept it, so it's irrelevant. But yet, you know, the United States achieved that all Arab governments, including Syria and Lebanon, signed into that peace plan for solution, a so-called ostensible solution to the Arab-Israeli question. The Syrian government, I believe, is now... In Syria, you have two counter-revolutions, I call them. I mean, sometimes you may have an uprising that can be hijacked. I believe in Libya, there was a genuine uprising in Benghazi. It started secular. The Bin Ladenites, fanatics, were not there. The lawyers of Benghazi were the one who triggered the uprising in Libya. And then, when NATO unleashed its firepower, and when a fanatical army was being recruited by Qatar, generously funding it, then, just like an international army of fanatical Islamists was formed in Afghanistan against the Soviet occupation, now there is another effort. And I'm thinking, this is a movie I've seen before. And the results were not pleasant, neither to Arab nor to the Americans. And yet we're seeing it again. And you will not know from Western newspapers that some of the militia leaders in Libya, the ones that were brought to power by the United States firepower, have been threatening the United States recently. And yesterday they destroyed the burial site for British soldiers from Second World War. So, I mean, they have not suppressed their anti-Western intentions as of yet, but that was discarded in order to achieve the overthrow of the regime. In the case of Yemen, there was a genuine uprising. There's still a genuine uprising in Yemen. It's still going on, but the United States and its allies want to steal it. In Syria, it was certainly a genuine uprising. It is very justified. And yet, the Qataris and the Saudis stepped in. They produced, this is another film. This is like the exile opposition of Iraq, which we saw prior to the invasion of 2003. There are people who have been out of Syria since the 1970s who are now speaking on behalf of the Syrian people. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I left Lebanon in 1983. And whenever I am asked to speak, when I speak in the Middle East, I'm asked for what kind of solutions do I propose to various problems that people face. And I tell them, I don't have that right to give you solutions. I have been living in the United States all these years. I lost that right. People who are there should decide. And yet yesterday in the Friends of Israel conference in Tunisia, the head of the Syrian National Council, Burhan Ghalioun, spoke on behalf of the whole Syrian people. The whole Syrian people. Somebody who's been living in France since the 1970s. But we've seen that in Iraq. I mean, in Iraq, the United States relied on exile group to represent the Iraqis. And what did we see? Remember Ahmed Shalabi, the hero? The United States went to Iraq and found out, according to a CIA report that was leaked to the New York Times, that most Iraqis have never heard of him. And the few who've heard of him, according to the language of the report, got a strong urge to puke. I wonder what they said in Arabic. Got a strong urge to puke. In the last election, Ahmed Shalabi was able to win one seat only because he latched on to the force of Muqtada al-Sadr. In the election previous to that, he could not win one seat. Not one seat. And the puppet of the United States is now derided in the US media for being a puppet of Iran. In Syria, I think we are witnessing a similar movie. Although I discount military intervention in Syria by the United States for many reasons. I mean, it's going to be much messier than any other thing we've seen. And I also still remember the words of Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense, who said at West Point Military Academy last year that any future Middle Eastern president who considers launching a war against an Arab country will have to have his head examined. I think the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan are too fresh in people's minds. And I also believe the fact that Hezbollah borders on Syria is another reason why an intervention would be highly costly for NATO, the United States, or a combination there is. But I think there is... So in Syria, there was a genuine uprising. The Syrian regime brutally launched a counter-revolution against the popular uprising. And then the Saudis and the Qataris and the Americans and the Israelis are always not far behind, launch another counter-revolution to undermine or to direct the Syrian uprising in a particular direction that is convenient to the United States and its interests. And in that effort, they are working very closely with the Muslim Brotherhood of Syria, an organization that has been for sale for decades. An organization with a record of terrorism and sectarian killing going back all to the 1970s and 80s. And that is where the money and support is going by Qatar, Saudi Arabia, as well as various Salafite groups in Syria. However, as I conclude, I want to say this. I know that many Arabs, and I hear from many of them on Facebook and Twitter and emails, many Arabs now are in a state of semi-despair. They feel that a promising Arab uprising or season has been all but killed by the United States and the GCC, Qatar and Saudi Arabia notably. And they believe that Israelis, and we saw that in Egypt, will never allow Arabs to enjoy democracy because Israel can only live in the presence of a dictatorial order in the Middle East. It cannot exist in a democratic order in the region. It is for that the United States will fight tooth and nail against democratization of the Arab world. But I am not sure that the last verdict is in. I think the popular tide continues to march on. I see what's happening in Tunisia, what's happening in Egypt, what's happening in Yemen, people or Bahrain, or Qatif in Saudi Arabia. People are not submitting to the counter-revolution. They are pressing on, and they are exposing increasingly the plot by the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. And for that, I believe that we should measure. I mean, Lenin used to say that you measure politics with a measurement that can accommodate the eggs of ants. And I think that we should measure Arab uprising with a very long span that does not measure in weeks, does not measure in months, but measure in years. I am optimistic because the tyrannical order cannot return. I don't know what the outcome in Syria is going to be. Even if the regime survives, the Syrian people broke the barrier of fear. They did that in Egypt, in Tunisia. The United States cannot order them to shut down popular opinions anymore like before. And that means the system is now more open. And the openness of the system will allow for revolutionary sabotage. Revolutionary sabotage. And that will undermine the counter-revolution and will certainly not allow for a regime that is put by the counter-revolution to stick. And this is why in Yemen we have seen the installation of a puppet. But we may not wait for long before we see the change in the politics at the head of the government in Yemen itself. And I also believe that the United States has not learned its lesson, a lesson that was taken by consecutive conquerors of the region who thought they can impose their will by sheer force. And many of them stayed for long times and they left archaeological ruins, but they could not survive. They were kicked out one after one. And I think based on what we've seen last year, we have the reason to be optimistic that the Arabs this time will not give up the opportunity for the first time since World War I to really fulfill the promises of self-determination. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that great talk.
Can we have water, please? Water? Thank you. Thank you.
So now we're going to move to a discussion, and I think if you saw some of the discussion earlier today, it was great to have people give some questions and comments. And so I ask that everyone who wants to talk limit their comments or questions to less than 2 minutes, and I'll try to call on you by an article of clothing. And so if you want to ask a question, get my attention, and I'll point at you and try to take a stack. So you wanted to ask a question?
So you commented on the NATO intervention in Libya, but I wonder if you could speak specifically to some of the, in particular, people in the progressive left, such as Gilbert Achkar,
right,
who came out very strongly in support of humanitarian intervention. If you could speak directly to those arguments.
I should say on this question, I mean, I should not respond very specifically. Thank you so much, Hannah. I think on this specific question, I should not answer it specifically in the name of Gilbert Achkar, a colleague who teaches at SOAS at the University of London, because as you probably know, him and I have dueled in Arabic and English over the last 2 years. So I feel because he's not here to respond, I don't want to speak on his... Because of their history of the bitter arguments that him and I have had over the last 2 or 3 years, in fact. But I will speak in general. I believe that those on the left who spoke in favor of NATO intervention are nowhere to be seen. I mean, many of them who wrote in different languages in support of NATO intervention, I have not seen any of them coming back to justify their previous stances. And I call on them to do that so we can debate the issue. Second, I've noted that some of them, like Thomas Friedman in 2003, supported the war on Iraq wholeheartedly. And when the results of the war were clear, he started pretending that he was against the war all along. And I think some people who support NATO intervention are doing the same. I think that the best argument against NATO intervention is to look at what's happening in Libya. I mean, one of the last articles of the fine reporter, Anthony Shadid, one of the best correspondents in the region, was written for the New York Times after he went to Libya to see how things are. I mean, people in Libya stay in their houses. There is massive corruption, and the fanatical militias, the Bin Ladenite. I mean, a former prisoner in the Guantanamo is now like running the scene in Tripoli. I mean, that's how absurd the scene is, which is not covered adequately in the New York Times. And I think the results speak for themselves. Let them justify it.
Right. Its political system is a little unwieldy. And have you asked that question? And what have you come up with?
Well, I mean, my answer to that is, this is something I've studied a lot, of course, in my dissertation and so on. My answer to that is that Lebanon managed to maintain its independence by never being independent all along. And by never pretending to be independent. This is a country, in my opinion, that never enjoyed one day of independence. It was a country that was subject to French rule, and then the so-called war of independence was really not a war of independence. We basically took advantage of a window opportunity of a conflict between Britain and France, and we went through that loophole, and the British achieved that result for us. And after that, this country has been a satellite, either of for a long time for the United States, for Britain in the 1950s, believe it or not, for the Syrian regime for a very long time. But now there is discord. Half of Lebanon is a satellite for one element of the regional conflict, and another half is subject to the other part of the regional conflict. So this place has never been independent. I mean, this is why I've always argued there were entities in the Middle East that were created as sectarian or ethnic or tribal projects to serve as supporters of the Zionist entity. I believe Lebanon and Jordan are very much like that. And that's why I've always, since my youth, argued for their dissolution as entities. And I mean, eventually when there is a free order in Syria and elsewhere, I mean, those two countries can be dissolved within them and not to exist as these separate artificial entities that have no viability at all.
And in the back.
And Oregon.
When we're looking at free orders in the Middle East, you were talking about, and other speakers have mentioned, that some of the best organized entities right now that have the support of the West as well are Islamist groups. And right. You use the word reactionary, also opportunistic, you know, in talking about Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. And you yourself are an atheist, and a lot of us in the West, as well as people in the Middle East, see kind of a secular model as maybe optimal in the Middle East or otherwise. I'm wondering what you see as the role of religion or religious groups
right.
In the Arab Spring and beyond.
Well, Hannah, I'm sure you agree with me that this is a matter that the Arabs should decide for themselves. That is not for the West to decide whether they should have a secular or non-secular government. The second point, of course, is that the last country that can ever preach the message of secularism to the Arab world or to any other place in the world is the United States. I mean, if this is France or some other European secular country and so on, I would take it, but not from the United States. The third point is, you're right. I mean, there are secular forces in the region, and they have existed. I mean, yes, the Islamists won in Tunisia, 39-40% of the vote. In Egypt, much bigger, 70% of the vote. But there are things that we are not mentioning. They received the largesse of Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Hundreds of millions of dollars were used by these two countries, in Egypt in particular, and to the glee of the United States, because the United States was more afraid of the radical alternatives. The secular radical alternatives, the leftists, the socialists, and so on, the anti-Nasserists, the anti-Israeli forces. I have said the Muslim Brotherhood are opportunistic, and I say that rather descriptively, in the dictionary term, in that they conveniently change their positions depending on who's asking and in what language. I mean, the leader of Al-Nahda, Rashid Al-Ghannouchi, came to Washington, D.C., said that he will not support a clause in the Tunisian constitution which would prohibit normalization with Israel. He said many reassuring things off the record. Goes back to the Arab world, asked about them in Arabic, said, we will never recognize Israel, we'll never have dealing with Israel, and so on and so forth. They are speaking two languages. The United States government says that the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt gave them assurances about the protecting of the Egyptian-Israeli treaty. In Arabic, they said they have never given these assurances at all. So, I mean, they obviously do that. And I can use Hamas as an example of the shifty kind of organizations in the way they fluctuate. On the one hand, they say Fatah, and it is a puppet of the occupation and should be dealt with as such. And yet recently they are having a unity government with those puppets of occupation. Which way is it? So, I mean, plus, these movements have, for a very long time, showed weaknesses to oil money. I mean, Khalid Mish'al, the head of Hamas, was quoted in Al-Quds Al-Arabi as saying the following. Hamas, as you all know, is begging Saudi Arabia to receive its leaders. They begged that Ismail Haniyeh and Khalid Mish'al visit Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government told them, we will not receive you unless you sever all ties with Iran. And Khalid Mish'al said, we cannot cut our ties to Iran because they give us so much money. I mean, the movement is offering itself for sale. I mean, if this is not opportunism, if the shifts on Arab-Israeli question, I mean, a very fundamental principle for a movement that claims it is a resistance organization, you know. However, on the role of religion, I mean, I think this is something that people have to figure out on their own. But I argue that the rise of Islamist parties, the underlying causes for their rise, as ironic as this may sound, are not religious in nature. They have to do with the exhaustion and the disillusionment with previous ideologies. They have to do with the fact that many of these groups suffered under previous regimes. They have to do with the fact that these are the only available large mass organizations. They have to do with the fact that they are receiving so much money, and as a result they can give charity to the poor. And all that is electorally beneficial. But I think we should see the transformation. If you look at the final results of the Tunisian elections, you will see that 40% went to the Islamists, but the rest largely were leftists. Unfortunately, they were fragmented. So they don't add up to one block. So three here, four there, five seats, and so on and so forth. And then one major leftist coalition, the one that led by Mustafa al-Marzouki, the president, had an under-the-table deal with the Islamists, sold out the seculars.
Yeah, I had a question about what your take on the long-term and short-term interests of kind of the Zionists in Israel are. What are their goals, short-term and long-term? And what are the possibilities of a regime change in Israel, where we can see something better coming out in Israel?
Well, I mean, let me answer the second part because it's much easier. I mean, I do not aspire for regime change in Israel. I mean, I just came back from a tour of universities in England titled The Case Against Israel, The Very Existence of Israel. I know this is the hardest sell in America, but that's been always my position in my teens. I am against the very existence of the State of Israel, and this is not a genocidal call like my Zionists have been saying against me on campus watch in the last 2 weeks. In fact, this is a recipe for re-coexistence of Jews and Arabs in the land. Nobody can expel anybody. It's like apartheid in South Africa. The dismantlement of apartheid South Africa did not result in the extermination of whites in South Africa. Similarly, the dismantlement of apartheid of Israel is not going to lead to the extermination or expulsion of the Jews of Palestine. I am for them being coexisting in one state that is not religious, neither Jewish nor Muslim nor Christian, but living not as master and slave, not as master and slave, but as equal, under one all-encompassing flag. And I add to that, because I'm often asked, I am also for the return of Arab Jews into Arab countries, and their compensation too. I mean, we can create real justice. The first part of the question for the goal of Israel, I believe they are very sinister, and I don't believe they are in any way disguised. Look what they did to Mubarak. And I'm very happy about that. Israel exposed its intention more than ever for me somebody who mobilizes and agitates against Israel in several languages. I've never seen that done as well as what Israel freaked out about the fall of Mubarak. It meant the Egyptian people and the Arab people as a whole saw that the dictatorial rule in the Arab world are not accidental. They were put by design. The United States and Israel want to preserve these regimes because they are good for them. They are not good for the people, but they are good for Israel. So one of the goals is certainly that. Two, Israel wants to continue its ability to scare and intimidate Arabs through the perpetration of successive massacres and war crimes without any punishment. Without any punishment. That ability, however, has been really undermined in 2006. If the media, Saudi media and Western media, are not as biased in favor of Israel, you would have learned details about the extent to which the Israeli military was humiliated on the grounds of Lebanon, in South Lebanon, by a bunch of hundreds of volunteers. Hundreds of volunteers. There's a museum of resistance in South Lebanon. Anybody in this room been to that museum? You see, that's the difference between England and the United States. Every university I spoke at in England, from London all the way to Scotland, I would ask that question, like 5-10 people would have been there. Anyway, there is a resistance dedicated to the fight against Israel, and you would see the extent to which there were results achieved in that. For the first time, the Arab fighters were not afraid of the Israelis. The Israelis were afraid. I am from South Lebanon. You talk to some of the people who stayed in the villages. They heard the screams of Israeli fighters, soldiers, elite troops. What's the name of that famous brigade? The Jolani Brigade. They were running for their lives, scared of Hezbollah fighters. These are youngsters. You see? So as a result, Israel is not going to stop these massacres and war crimes, have a strong urge to continue to launch more and more for that. Three, since 1942, when the Zionist movement shifted its center of political gravity from England, from Europe where it used to hold its Zionist conferences, to the United States, David Ben-Gurion made the calculation that the United States is going to be the center for our foreign policy goals and organization. So they held their first Congress for the Zionists in New York City in Biltmore Hotel, 1942. Since then, one of the goals, of course, is to continue in any way possible to have this country on their side, because they know without the United States, Israel is going down. I mean, don't take my word for it. Look at public opinion surveys around the world. I mean, when I was touring England, I felt like I was speaking, as I did a few years ago, on campuses in Islamabad, Pakistan. I mean, that is the extent of hostility to Israel on college campuses in the United Kingdom. The United States is a separate island, but you can see that in the votes on Arab-Israeli issues at the General Assembly every summer. Every summer, there are votes on Palestine in the General Assembly, not the Security Council. The General Assembly. And every year, the results are very clear. On the one hand, there are the countries of the world, the whole world, 140, 130, 150. And on the other side, Israel and its friends. Usually, Israel, the United States, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. This year, Canada joined them. European countries often abstain. But that's the extent. So for that, support by the United States is a matter of survival for the state of Israel. Don't get me wrong, however. I am in no way saying, pessimistically, that the United States can guarantee the survival of the state of Israel. If things over there change on the ground, nothing will save Israel. Nothing was able to save apartheid South Africa and the white supremacist regime there. And when Mubarak fell, what could the United States do? If the Palestinians don't do anything except procreate, in 20 years, they'll be half of the population of historic Palestine. I mean, how long will Israel be able to live against the wishes of the majority of the population, not to mention the population of the region as a whole?
The gentleman in the blue shirt.
I should give shorter answers, I believe. Yeah.
Good answers.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have three topical points, rather short.
What's that? I can hear you.
Right.
I guess the first one is... Start with the third one. Yes, go ahead.
It's my own and, you know, presenting the Arab case, what do you feel is the legitimacy of Samuel Musa as a presidential candidate in Egypt at this point?
Right. You, go with this, the other two.
Oh, the other two?
Yeah.
Right. Well, the other two, the Nir Rosen is going around with this, I guess, his assessment of the conditions in Syria, and he's saying that...
Who?
Nir Rosen, this, you know...
Oh, Nir, yeah, yeah.
So he was claiming that, you know, he didn't think Turkish intervention was very likely, and he claimed, and I suspect my disbelief with this, that Turkey had less Arabists in its foreign policy department than the U.S. did in Cairo. Suspending my disbelief in that, I want to know your thoughts on the likelihood of Turkish intervention in
right.
Syria,
right.
Whether it might occur or not. My third part concerns a point on your blog about Mustafa Barghouti. That might be safe for last
one. Right. Well, I mean, I'd like to begin with the last one. I mean, in the case of Mustafa Barghouti, it's an easy one. Mustafa Barghouti, as you know, I've been following him for a while, and he added me on Facebook even, but I've been very unhappy about his recent stances. I think he's becoming too much of an ambitious politician, and ever since I wrote about him on the blog, many people in Ramallah wrote to me adding some information and opinions about him, against him. I believe he's becoming too ambitious. I believe he is like putting himself and his name as a possible replacement for Salam Fayyad type of a prime minister. And as a result, he is like speaking so much to the Western audiences. I mean, he wrote a long editorial in the New York Times. I don't know if you've read it. Basically, he's pleading the case for nonviolent struggle by Palestinians. And I thought to myself, if you are sincere, why not write it in Arabic in a newspaper on Palestine? I mean, when people... What's that? What's that?
Doesn't Marwan Barghouti say the same thing in jail?
You're talking about Mustafa or Marwan?
They're not related?
No. Different people. Not to be confused. It's like confusing me with Thomas Friedman. Yeah. Different people altogether. No, Mustafa Barghouti, I mean... why should you say that message in the New York Times? And then to throw in a sentence which really bothered me about we are not aiming at delegitimizing Israel. I mean, should the movement for the liberation of Palestine and opposition to Israeli occupation be premised on delegitimization of Israel? What is delegitimization of Israel if not... I mean, what is delegitimization of occupation if not delegitimization of the state that was founded on brute force, occupation, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and displacement of an already existing nation? I mean, why should we be shy about that? Why? I know the climate of the United States is very intimidating. I know the New York Times as a platform is very intimidating. If you cannot express yourself freely in it, don't express yourself. And if that's your true message, write it in Arabic, if it's sincere. But I think he's not speaking to the Palestinians. He's presenting his credentials to the white man. The second point you asked about is an easy one, about Nir Rosen. I mean, Nir and I have been arguing privately on emails about his recent articles and interviews on Al Jazeera English. And I read the ones you mentioned when he spoke about the Turkish foreign ministry. I believe he went too far about that. My impression is that the Turkish intelligence service is, in fact, pretty present in Arab countries, and they are very active. I'll tell you one example. I mean, I've always been critical of Turkish government and its foreign policies, and unlike many of you here, I was not impressed with their stand on the, flotillas of Gaza. And I also believe that the Turkish government is not going to stick to its position, because for me, the measure is they have hundreds of secret military intelligence treaties with Israel. If they canceled them, I believe them. They didn't. So I was not. However, in the summer of 2010, I was in Lebanon, and there was a demonstration supporting the Palestinians. And I was in the demonstration in downtown Beirut. And suddenly, and I wrote about it in the blog at the time, I saw something very suspicious. Various banners in Turkish and flags of the Turkish government were circulated among the protesters. And many of them were like really enthusiastic about Turkey at the time. So they were very happy to receive flags and banners about Turkey in English and so on and so forth. But the thing is, I felt that Turkey is extremely active. And also Turkey launched an Arabic language TV service. So, I mean... they clearly are aiming at the Arab world, and I believe that Nir overstated his case about that. But I can ask him about that. I wanted to argue with him at this point, but I was busy arguing with him more about other points on that subject. The first question you asked was about Amr Musa, and that's an easiest one. I mean, you should read Muhammad Hassanein Haykal's book, which just came out, about Hosni Mubarak. In that book, you see a profile of Hosni Mubarak that we've never read, as incompetent, as buffoonish as he is, and so on. But you also see how he treated Amr Musa. I mean, this is a protege of Mubarak. This is somebody who was run by the Saudi Foreign Ministry all these years. However, I will give you this, because I've been watching him. He's extremely skillful. He is running a campaign very much in the American campaign mode. He's speaking very directly to the public. He's hired a staff. He does public opinion surveys. He articulates his message very clearly. He's a very good speaker, one of the best speakers we have in the Arab world. And he also, unlike in English, often speaks extremely sympathetically to the Palestinians and against Israel, which he does not do in English. I am not sure he's going to be successful in his efforts, however. There are many things going against him. I believe the Egyptian people are not going to go for somebody who is a holdover from the Mubarak regime. I cannot make my answers shorter, really. I'm trying, really.
You first, then you.
I do have three questions, but you may answer.
Start with the third one.
Third one?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to start with the first one,
right,
because at this point is more important to me.
Right.
Of the three of the Arab countries and the uprisings,
right,
between Egypt, Syria, and Tunisia, which one do you think has a better chance for a relatively democratic future?
Okay. Second question.
Second question, I think it's sort of related to the first one. Sort of like, depending on what happens in those countries is the future of secular forces in those countries.
Okay.
Like Algeria 6 in Egypt, what will happen to them if the brothers came to power, basically wanted to deal with these young forces?
Third?
And the third one is Saudi and Iran competition and animosities.
Right.
Okay, they both have money. Saudis have more
right.
money.
Much more.
Much more money. Iran has more problems in the country. I mean, they have to deal with the sanction and others. But still, both of them have a lot of money. Both of them are supporting. I mean, Iran is supporting the government in Iraq. Of course, Syria. Of course, Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got Saudis that mm-hmm. are now wanting Assad to go. And of course, Sunni forces and others. And Wahhabism.
Right.
How do you see their animosity, competition?
Right.
How important that is compared to the forces in the ground
right.
in these countries, U.S. foreign policy, the West, Russia, and China, of course. Outside world
right.
and their
forces. Right. I mean, on the first question, I am much more optimistic about Egypt. I feel Egypt is going to set the trend for the rest. What will happen in Egypt will inspire or will depress the Arab people elsewhere. I do believe that the momentum of the Egyptian youth has been so strong that it has forced the hand of the military council. I do believe that they are now handling the Muslim Brotherhood with a very acute eye, looking for their inconsistencies, hypocrisies, and promises. And I do believe that eventually, once there is a presidential election and so on, the Egyptian open system is going to allow new forces to emerge and new political parties that we have not heard before. And this is related to your second part question, which is, I mean, that's where the secular forces are going to come in. And I think that in the cases of the Islamists so far, they have not impressed their public. I mean, in the case of Egyptian parliament, they started a debate about how to ban obscene and pornographic websites. In the case of Libya, the first promise he made was polygamy. Now, even if people are pious Muslims in the Middle East, and many are, not all of them, I mean, these are not priorities. These are not priorities. And you see the cases of in Tunisia, they are discussing blasphemies and laws about blasphemies and so on and so forth. So, I mean, that's my view on that. So Egypt, I think, is, for me, the one that I am optimistic about. Even though Tunisia Tunisia also has promises. Why? Because in Tunisia there's a very vibrant leftist movement. Very vibrant leftist movement. And has refused to be intimidated by the Islamists. On the competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran, that's a big question, so I have to be very brief about that. I will say that Saudi Arabia and Iran have been fighting this battle for a very long time. But since 2003, Saudi Arabia resorted to a very effective yet deadly weapon, blatant sectarian warfare. Blatant sectarian warfare. I mean, there are hateful campaigns against Shiites, Qashiites, in all Saudi media. I mean, Saudi Arabia, the audience should understand, controls more than 80% of Arab channels. In the Middle East, there are 700 satellite channels. Most of them are run by Saudi Arabia or their business affiliates. Like yesterday, today I was reading the New York Times and they said about an Arabic news station called Al Arabiya, they said, it's a private Saudi station. Private? It's owned by the brother-in-law of King Fahd of Saudi Arabia. How private is that? You know? And it's being run by the son of King Fahd, who is the nephew of the king today. I mean, private Saudi channel. Those media are blatant in their campaign against Shiites. As a result, that really put movement that are Shiite in identity on the defensive. Hezbollah and Iran, so on. And they are not, and Syria is not even responding to attacks on it by Saudi Arabian media. But the thing I argue is, well, if they are not sectarian, they would have responded. I mean, yesterday Hassan Nasrallah, for the first time in a very long time, spoke about what's happening in Saudi Arabia. Originally, they have been avoiding mentioning Saudi Arabia because they're afraid. If they speak, they say, these are Shiite agents of Iran and so on and so forth. The war continues, and Saudi Arabia has much more in its arsenal. Money, Western support, the Arab tyrannical order, and it claims to be an Arab. And they use that to also engage in racist mobilization against all Iranians. I mean, the term that is now used in Saudi media is Safavid forces, Safavid states, Safavid movement. And one time I wrote in Arabic, those who are using that language are so ignorant about the glories of the Safavid dynasty. I mean, have you read about Isfahan in Safavid rule? I mean, how many the shopping malls that we have today, these are from the design of shopping malls outdoors that were in Safavid Isfahan at the time. I mean, Isfahan was one of the most advanced cities in the whole world of its time. But they think Safavid must be backward, I mean, and that's how they're using it. Both of them are using money, I should say. But in the Lebanese election, Saudi Arabia is estimated to have spent $1 billion. The other side, Iran, did not give not even one quarter of that money.
So the next session starts at 3:30, so I think we have time for maybe one more question.
Okay.
And the gentleman with the red button back there.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you very much for being here. I just wanted to get some of your opinions on the correlation maybe or similarities or maybe stuff that people here in America, United States, can learn that are with the Occupy Portland, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy the World movement. What we can learn from the people struggling for their rights still in the Arab uprising?
I mean, that's such a good question. And I should say that the Occupy movement is it's spreading without exaggeration. Every city I visited in United Kingdom last month had an Occupy movement, from London to Edinburgh to Glasgow, I think. And I think the lesson is the Egypt one. The Egypt one basically is how no matter how much force was used against them. I mean, at one point, Hosni Mubarak ordered fighter jets to be flown over the heads of the protesters to scare them. Fighter jets given by the United States. The United States did not speak against that. They were threatening to bomb them from the air in Tahrir Square. And yet, they did not go home. No matter what they did against them, they pressed on and on. And so that's one. Second, in the Egyptian case at least, they are able to tie the relationship between the political order and the financial order, the business sector. I mean, here there was something like that about the 1%. But I think here, I mean, the left is weak, and also some of it is tied to the Democratic Party. And I believe that you cannot press on with an agenda for income equality in this country without going against the two parties. I mean, I was reading an article in The Economist on the plane of the super PACs. I mean, the super PACs are for both parties. I mean, Obama is sending his secretaries to speak in fundraisers for the super PACs. And who are these people? These are the 1%. And the other thing is, I think, in the United States, which I've always noticed, is that the momentum is very weak, extremely weak. I remember in 1990, there was an anti-war movement building up against the war back then. I spoke on college campuses. I felt something is building. And then when the war was launched, died down. I experienced the same thing in 2003. Before the war, there was a strong movement going on. I spoke on college campuses and so on, and then the war was launched. I think maybe it boils down in this country, when it comes to war, the worship of the military. That's true of the youth, and that's true of the rest of society. The worship of the military is basically allowing the war crimes by U.S. troops to be committed around the world. And that's why there has been no repercussions to what happened in Afghanistan. And look how we are lied to. First of all, they don't tell us how many Qurans were burned. They said a number of them. We don't know. I mean, most likely it's hundreds of them, if not more. Second, they say they were mistakenly burned. Let's see. So U.S. soldiers were walking, mistakenly started dumping hundreds of Quran in a garbage dump, and mistakenly set them on fire. I mean, but look what they do now. To try, I mean, they speak, they still, like colonial powers, they speak to Arabs and Muslims like they are idiots. What did they say? The U.S. military said they are investigating. I'm sure it's a mechanical error, just like the helicopters are being downed by rebels in Iraq and Afghanistan. They never admit it's like insurgents fire. They say it's mechanical error. They will say the same about the Quran. But they said something more. They said they are going to subject all the troops to special training about the handling of the Quran. Who are you insulting? What kind of training do you need to figure if you take holy books of a faith, put them in a garbage dump and set them on fire, it's offensive? I mean, do you need to take a certificate in that? The special course at the college campus? Thank you all for coming, by the way.
It's really a pleasure.